So welcome everyone. My name is Dan Castillo. I, along with Paul Griffith, who's under the overhang here, will be working with you and journeying with you on these four sessions, which you are not obligated to come beyond the time you're here. You're not obligated to stay today. But we'll be working together this week to think about practicing Jubilee within the planetary emergency. Just kind of to orient you, I will kind of put an outline for the day over here as we start, and I'll probably add some words and terminology as we go on the whiteboard here as we're flipping through the PowerPoint presentation. As we begin, I was born in Miami. I did my PhD at Notre Dame, and I now teach at Loyola University, Maryland in Baltimore. Been there for 8 years. My work is really at the nexus of liberation theology and environmental ethics, and thinking about how to connect the two together. So, in kind of popular phrasing, right? Thinking about how the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor are interrelated to one another or relate to one another, and then thinking about, as a Christian theologian, what does it mean to live faithfully, responsibly before God, before neighbor, before the earth, in light of these two cries, right? As we begin now, why don't you just turn to a neighbor, introduce yourself, and because we'll go back and forth with people that you're sitting next to talk about a few things. Introduce yourself and maybe share what comes to mind when you think of, when you hear the term planetary emergency. Take 60 seconds. So, anyone want to throw out a couple terms, just things that came to mind real quickly?
Climate change.
Action.
Late stage capitalism.
Hatred.
Heat.
Migration.
Tribalism. Tribalism.
So what I want to point out right now is when, and we'll unpack this a little bit more pretty quickly now. When we talk about the planetary emergency, or you hear often, right, the ecological crisis, actually emergency is a better term to use, right? Emergency, like, is something that demands a response. A crisis you may or may not, if you actually like get down to the nitty-gritty with the etymology and what's being communicated, you may or may not be able to do anything. You may or may not be called to do anything. An emergency, there's an ethical imperative immediately. But what I want to point out from what all of you just said, right, is it's not just environmental, and it's not just social, it's political ecological. Right? It's an eco-social emergency, it's a political ecological emergency. It has to do, it's an emergency rooted in how human beings have used their agency to order the earth, the oikos of the earth, the household. Economics, ecology, both come from oikos in Greek. So this is a political ecological emergency. And that's what we're going to explore, right? We're not obviously going to be able to hit on all notes. We will hit on a few of them. For about 12,000 years, give or take, since the receding of the last ice age, the glaciers from the last ice age, which actually I don't know, maybe carved this area, we have lived, the Earth has existed, geologists tell us, right, in the Holocene for about 12,000 years. And the thing with the Holocene, sometimes people say, well, you know, like, Earth, if it wasn't for humans, the Earth would be in a state of stasis. No. Right? The Earth is always in a state of flux, always changing, always dynamic. But what's important to note when we're thinking about deep time and geological conversations is relative to other geological eras, the Holocene was remarkably placid, remarkably stable. Right? So if the fluctuations in other times, right, in other geological eras were something like this, right, when you get to the Holocene, it's something like this. pretty inviting as geological eras go. And it's in fact the conditions for the possibility of human societies and civilizations to flourish. And what geologists are now saying is we've moved in, this has not become officially accepted, but it's moving that way within kind of academic discourse and all that, is we've moved out of the Holocene and we've moved into the Anthropocene. The age in which human beings have become the primary driver of biophysical change, or a primary driver of biophysical change on a planetary level. Planetary scale. It's a mouthful. RPG. Yeah. And really, you don't have to understand it all the way, just get a sense, right? It's the age, the geological age, in which human beings have become the primary, a primary driver of biophysical change on a planetary scale. Give me a minute. Let me. One thing, I'll pause like throughout the our time together. If you could try and hold your questions to there. I would appreciate it just so I can keep my train of thought going. I'm going to put human beings up here. In quotes, because we're going to come back to this. The term Anthropocene, I think, tells us something that's very true, that's very important, that we have to think about. It's also going to conceal something that's, in fact, potentially very violent if it stays concealed. So we'll come back to this question in, I don't know, 5-10 minutes. This is perhaps my favorite image to relate to think about the Anthropocene. Take a couple minutes, take a minute to reflect on it, and then I'll ask you to turn to a neighbor and talk about what you see going on here. If you need to move forward, and feel free to, if you want to walk around, just try and avoid blocking other people up. So go ahead, if you haven't already started, take another minute, talk to your neighbor, talk to a couple neighbors about what you see going on here, what strikes you.
Exploration is horrifying and overwhelming.
Okay, so seeing it in the collage, seeing all of this is horrifying and overwhelming. Overwhelming is a good word. Tomorrow, we'll think about, like, today is about seeing, right? Tomorrow is, once we really start to see this, once we start to like, confront this, it's like dealing with the despair, with the grief that we can feel, the horror, right? And we'll move on from there. But yeah, horrifying is a good word.
There's a fire in the middle, no one's dealing with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I think, a platform for burning fossil fuel, right?
It's amazing to see everything in one place, because I can see this and this and this and this, all that's happening right in this world today.
Building on that, so I've had the opportunity to use this with students for like many semesters, right? And so you see it all in one place. What students have pointed out in the past is like, oh, we live here and all of this is out of our view, really.
No.
Right? It's a lot of it is. Distanciation is the fancy term that gets used. It's hidden from distance.
Is it a short-sightedness on their part? I mean, okay, you're from Miami. Yesterday I had a beautiful orange at lunch. Uh-huh. Oranges don't grow here.
Mm-hmm.
right, how much carbon did it take to get that orange here so I can enjoy it in a place where oranges don't grow?
So the processes of consumption have built into them the dynamics that hide the costs.
So do your students just know they haven't been exposed?
They may or may not be thinking about that at all.
Okay.
And I would say, to cut my students slack, right, on a daily basis, this is what I teach. I'm not thinking about that when I go pick up an orange necessarily, right?
But you're from Miami.
But from here, I'm not thinking about it per se. I mean, sometimes I'll stop and say, oh, what am I doing? Like this shouldn't be here. I mean, it's already here, so I'm going to eat it. But
well, as long as we're on that path,
yeah.
The way I'm built is if I put my hand on a hot stove, I don't have to think about whether I want to take it off. I get an immediate visceral reaction that says, mm-hmm. take it off! And what we've done in the Anthropocene is, not necessarily intentionally, but we've ended up disconnecting the senses from the costs of, you know, in hiding. It's like people can say, well, we're bad because we're not thinking about X, Y, Z, but we're not built to think about it. We're built to react to our senses, and we cut our senses off from the consequences of our actions.
Very good. And tied to that, right, related to that, is this sense, and this is a big word, right, that we should think about, or like an important word, is all of this is structural, right? So when we are acclimatized, acclimated to living within those structures, there's no imperative impulse to pull your hand off.
Yeah.
It's what has been created as home for you.
Yeah.
Perhaps not for everybody. We'll get to this.
She mentioned the absence or the lack of clarity about any military presence in the thing, and what it brought to mind is, so my husband's a cattle rancher, and there's this sense of it's really like a defensive mechanism to say, like, okay, sure, like maybe we do this, but we also do carbon sequestration, and what about them? And that, so I can see people in various industries kind of deflecting to the other because there are so many components.
Right.
And that sense of like, yeah, but this is like, we're like 8%. What about the 25%? You know what I mean? That,
right,
that kind of,
absolutely.
And it's
this
all
is
about what data you're actually using to kind of justify or not. Your presence within that structure.
And ethicists will talk about these as wicked problems, in part because they're so complex, but part of the wickedness of it is because they're so complex, you can always push off of somebody else. Well, this is what needs to get fixed, this is what needs to get fixed. I'm cool.
Yeah.
I would say, like, this has always struck me as maybe a general devouring the world, right? Five-star general and militarism as a clear dimension of all of these processes.
Yeah, if I may really quick, just one thing to speak to what I'm sorry, what is your name?
Emily.
Hi, Emily. Yeah. So, one of the best parallels I've heard to that is when you look at the Shoah. So that's the preferred term for the Holocaust, right? So the Shoah, it was so systemic, so structural, so mechanized. Hey, I'm not the one causing genocide. I just hit the rubber stamp. Hey, I'm not the one causing genocide. I just, you know, pull this lever. Hey, I'm not the one causing genocide. I just do this. So it's very, it gives us a cognitive dissonance, a way out,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead, and then I'm going to say a couple things.
Well, I have another observation, and that is, this is all man-made. There are no floods, there's no hurricanes, there's no God-made part of it.
So you have strip mining, you have water privatized for sale over here, you have factory farming, you have the effluents from the factory farming, you have monocrop, oil burning, the rich living on their private island with the yacht sequestered from it all, perhaps a general devouring the world. I thought I heard someone say it over here, and it's my favorite comment from a student. They said, there's just a lot going on in this. Oh my God. Look at how much. Imagine how the earth feels, right? In a given ecosystem.
Right.
So, another way to think about the Anthropocene is, again, now there's debates about this from geologists. I mean, the debates go back, like, the Anthropocene started with the first human. The general consensus is moving towards, even with, again, there's going to be debates, but we'll point to this, right, for practical purposes. The Anthropocene probably, as it seeds, they'll say, in the Industrial Revolution, I'll question that in a minute, or I'll complicate that in a minute, but kind of really is birthed during the period called the Great Acceleration. So 1945, post-World War, through the end of the century, right? I mean, through today. There's some signs it may be slowing down. But look at this. I'll point out to a couple of these. Just take, this is human impact, and the resolution isn't great. Going back hundreds of years, thousands of years, and it's in the last, this is the Industrial Revolution, so these are going back hundreds of years. Industrial Revolution, 45. Industrial Revolution, 45. On any number of markers. Let me see if I can see this more clearly. Nah, it's not coming up. So, ozone depletion, right? Ocean acidification. Atmospheric CO2 concentration, climate change. Total real GDP, wealth. And this actually points to a complicating factor. There is one more that I want to show you. I mean, the number of McDonald's is here somewhere. But again, all of these different measures, everything in the last 50 to 70 years just exploding in terms of human impact. Right. And, well, cool, like, GDP's going up, people, maybe some people are living better, and we can obviously, I'm assuming most people here are somewhat sensitive to, like, the dramatic economic inequality, right? But GDP's going up, the world's getting wealthier. But it can't be sustained, right? Even if we're able to attend to the issues of inequality, that trajectory is what Johan Rockström and a number of other of his colleagues who've worked on thinking about what the Earth can handle to remain in conditions that are similar to the Holocene, right? He defined 9 planetary boundaries, and they're still working out some of it. Climate change, CO2 is just one, right? So there's certain thresholds. If we pass the threshold for CO2 in the atmosphere, concentration of CO2, then we're entering like a tipping point where we don't know what's going to happen. It's not going to be good. It's going to break us out of conditions that have been hospitable to humanity, to human civilization. Right? Climate change is what we get, what everyone's talking about, and rightly so. It's a significant one. It's 1 of 9. We've already, like, the amount of nitrogen that is in our, like, land and water cycles is unsustainable. Any one of these by themselves is an emergency. Land system change, so this is the region of, it's unclear whether we can handle it or not. This is a safe zone. We're moving towards, like, the threshold for, like, known unsustainable point of, not point of no return, but point where we need to figure out a way to remediate really quickly. We're moving towards that with land system change. And what this points to is biodiversity loss. So the sixth great extinction that we're moving into. Right? Because land system change is, in effect, we're going to use this for a very narrow economic purpose, and all the animals living on it, all the fauna, all the antifauna, not our concern. So, I don't have the exact stat, but there's been a couple of studies that have come out. Never mind the Great Extinction, right? The sixth Great Extinction. Entofauna, like, are on the verge of entering into, like, loss of 80% biomass on the planet, right? Like just the amount of insects that we have on the earth are on the verge of collapse. And if you think about that, right, insects are a building block to ecosystems. So we don't know what's going on. To use a house metaphor, right? They're the 2x4s upon which, like, you layer the drywall. They're the weight, the load bearing for the household. If you pull out too much of that, it's not safe, right? And this is just thinking in a narrow self-concern, like trajectory right now. So, our situation, right? Part of our situation, we've already said, so right now, right, we've been looking at some of the ecological, what we think about tradition as ecological, environmental dimensions of the planetary emergency. I want to turn to think some about the political, ecological, the social, economic dimensions of that emergency. And I want to do that by actually focusing a little bit on how did we get to this state? How did we launch headlong into this? How do we arrive at this moment of emergency in our lives, in our world, right, in our time? And my argument would be that this is why I would say the Industrial Revolution isn't the proper starting point for thinking about this, is you cannot understand, so my argument would be you cannot understand the planetary emergency and how we arrived here apart from understanding the history of Western extractive colonialism, right? That not only has driven us into this, but that has also shaped the political, ecological configurations of the world. It's a lot of terminology. I'll unpack this. It has not only driven us to this moment of tipping points, but it's also shaped the space of the Earth, how we've arranged geography, how we. So I said Western extractive colonialism. Enrique Dussel, and actually I think he gets it from Noam Chomsky, will talk about this as the 500-year project, right? So, and this term came around about in 1992, right? So on the quincentenary of anniversary of Columbus landing in Taino country. Title land. And what this is points, right, is colonialism and neocolonialism. Right? So you can't understand the planetary emergency apart from the ongoing, continuing project of colonialism, Western extractive colonialism and neocolonialism, and how this shaped our world. Okay. Eduardo Galeano, The Open Veins of Latin America, in the second page? Yep, second page. So just to think about Latin America now. It says, Latin America is the region of open veins. Everything from the discovery, and I'm assuming he's using it ironically there, from the discovery until our times has always been transmuted into European or later United States capital. And as such, has accumulated in distant centers of power. This is, so here's the, I should have bolded this. Everything, the soil, its mineral, its fruits, and its mineral-rich depths, the people and their capacity to work and to consume, natural resources, human resources, all of it has been transmuted into capital, into a resource, to be exploited, to be, right, Western extractive capitalism, to be extracted and enjoyed by certain persons, right, in distant centers of power. This is true not only of Latin America, right, this is true of North America at first, and still in North America in different ways, when you think about it, right? When you're thinking about scale, we can get to the micro. It's true in the global south, generally speaking. What I want to note here, and I'm going to give you another image to look at in a minute. is that there's a certain kind of reason, rationality at work in this, right? An instrumental reason that is going to reduce everything that is not the colonizer to an it, an object to do with as I see fit, if I'm the colonizer. Let me pause there to say there's problems with Bartolomé de las Casas. There's significant problems with him. His diagnosis for the 15th century, 16th century Spanish friar, right, Dominican friar, who was what would become the Americas very early on. And when he saw what the Spanish invaders were doing, he diagnosed the problem, right? He said, the Spanish are in fact, the indigenous peoples are not idolaters, right? This was the claim that was being put against them. They're not the true idolaters. The true idolaters are the Spanish because they've known the quote-unquote true God, right, as Las Casas. They've been exposed to Christ, and they worship gold. They worship greed. And so, this instrumental reason is being employed, right? Everything's in it. And what is my affection? What is my desire that's going to drive how I employ my instrumental reason? Accumulation of wealth, more, exalt me.
I think that we've been taught that we don't have enough, that we should be afraid, and that the only way that we can survive, as opposed to be exalted, it's if we don't consume, if we don't accrete, we will be trodden under by those who are trying to. So it's a scarcity rather than and I want more and I want to be great, I think. Anyway.
Well, so Irenaeus, the second century theologian, right, talks about, he has this famous saying, I don't know it in Latin, maybe I should, but the glory of God is the human person fully alive. Beautiful saying. Once a human person is created in the image of Leslie Sclair, a Marxist sociologist, global sociologist who lives in England, has a book on the transnational capitalist class. And what he says in that book, and he uses the language, I've communicated with him, I know he does not care at all about what Irenaeus thinks. But he says that, look, that what's shaping our world today, like the dominant ideology, is an ideology of, he calls it a culture ideology of consumerism, which projects homo consumens as the ideal person, right? So the consuming person as the ideal which we're to grab onto. And he says, in the culture ideology of consumerism, homo consumens is projected to the world as the human person fully alive. So again, the idolatry. What does it mean to be fully alive? What does it mean to be made in the image? Right? What does it mean to be truly human?
Dan, if I may really quick, also just consider how culturally we deify Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos. What matters is their power, their wealth, right? And this defines culturally, right? It doesn't mean every human thinks this way, but it's definitely culturally mediated for us. That this is what matters, right? And this is what we should strive for.
So we've got a lot to get through, so I want to make sure that we get to the stopping point for today. Don't read this quite yet. I know your eyes are going to want to go there. Just take a look at this, because now we're moving more into, we're going to start to question the human beings here. What's being communicated in this image? And I need to get the artist's name for you. I'm sorry, I tried to put that up. I don't have it right now. take a minute, talk to your neighbor. What strikes you? So what's striking you here? What's jumping out at you?
I see the very powerful woman holding a child. I mean, that to me is like, who do we listen to? Who do we pay attention to? And she has power.
Right. And so it's important, one of the things that you're pointing to right now, right, is, I gotta kind of name another part. The marginalized, the oppressed, those whose lives are being made most, put in the most precarious situation because of the planetary emergency. Like, there can be a tendency, an impulse, if you don't live in that space, if you don't identify with that space or with that identity, to say, well, I'm going to fix it, right? Or I'm the one with the agency. And anyone who would count themselves privileged, you have agency and you need to use it, right? But it's important to acknowledge the agency that is coming from all different locations, right? And honor that. And as you said, listen to it and respond to that. What else is jumping at you?
It also looks like that wave's not stopping. It's just gonna come.
That is a reality then.
But that is God. That's a God-given part of this picture.
Well, where God-given is a tricky. So, is it a quote-unquote naturally occurring? Part of it, yes. Part of it, no.
Yeah.
Right? It's rising. Rising sea levels,
yeah.
Rising heat, causing more intense storms, all of those things. And certainly, the inequality that's being suggested here is not a naturally occurring phenomenon.
That wave looks like this gigantic, greedy hand that's coming out of the reservoir. And for what? Like junk in the water. It's like we just want more and more and more, and we've just been, don't even need it. So we just toss it. There's so much. It's just floating around in the water.
And notice also, we can also connect that to the toxins and toxic oppression, right? That's a threat to our families and our homes.
All the people who are going to be divided by the wave are people of color.
Right. And this gets to a point that we'll come to with James Cook, but we'll talk about the racial dynamics of the 500-year project of Western extractive colonialism, how that maps onto ecological stress. Go ahead, Jim.
I think water tends to be one of the most overt ways to be able to see oppression happen. So I take, for example, Standing Rock and the pipeline. Mm-hmm. It was originally north of Bismarck. And then the white folks in Bismarck said, nope. So we'll just move it below Bismarck onto native land. And so it was just like really obvious, I feel like. And so sometimes if you just follow the water systems, you can actually find really overt examples of this happening. It, more so perhaps than some other environmental toxins.
Makes me think of and holding what she just talked about, or the person down there just spoke about with water and just the depletion of water, yet water's present, that lack of access to water in spaces. Thinking about the Global South and thinking about the black and brown of that community not running and standing, and like someone else shared, the woman being the one holding the child and the woman being the one to stand up and lead, as well as the woman is the one with the least access, decision-making power, least access to control over resources, over what happens, and has to take care of her body, the children's body, and has the most barriers in what happened to her own body, being used in collateral for violence, sexual, domestic, as well as just in sports and slavery.
Thank you. So you're raising up, especially the last part of what your comment, on an element, a dimension of the planetary emergency that we will not unpack here like in kind of a formal way, But it's important to name, and we can keep coming back to it informally throughout, right, is that, that all of this is gendered. Right? All of this is gendered in a number of complex ways, where women's bodies are made to be in a state of greater precarity, generally speaking, and in a systematic structural way. There's ways in which the ideology of exploitation and of colonialism uses a gendered imagination, a sexist, misogynistic imagination to work to try and attempt to justify its exploitation. We can try and pick up on that, some of that in the kind of closing discussion. What I want to turn to is another dimension right now of the planetary emergency. When we're thinking about, we talk about instrumental reason in service of greed, reducing everything to an it, to extract commodities. This is the opening passage from a great essay by James Cone, Whose Earth Is It Anyway? Just take a minute to read it. So remember the Galeano quote, right? Everything is going to be reduced to an object. The white extractive colonizing male is going to attempt to reduce everything to an it, to be put in service of accumulation, right? Land, labor. Well, that labor very, very quickly in the project, in fact, immediately, gets racialized. Right? We can say that the production of kind of modern conceptions of race begin here. There's lots of arguments to be made for that. Because whose bodies are going to become those most readily made vulnerable to being a tool for the purpose of extracting wealth? Black and brown. Right, so that instrumental reason takes human beings and says, we're not going to say you're a human being. We're going to say you're an object, a tool to serve us, in extracting wealth. And we've never gotten out of that space. As a global culture now, we're in that space, a global culture defined by global consumerism, global capital. We're in that space. The United States certainly has always been in that space. Give me one more. And this is true, right, not only of the attempt. So Akili Mbembe, a Cameroonian philosopher, has a great observation with regard to global capitalism, but it's true of the whole project, right? He says global capitalism produces and relies upon, for it to work, a racialized subsidy, right? The labor of BIPOC persons needs to be devalued in order to allow for greater accumulation by those in power. That begins, Cone is saying, here. And what's true of that, the racialized dynamics then of the planetary emergency also are true in the way we organize space, as we've already been hitting on it, right? Whose lives, what communities, generally speaking, are placed in the greatest danger? Whose lands are destroyed most readily to extract resources still today, right? Where are the toxins located, concentrated? Still today. These are all elements of the emergency that we're living in. An emergency that does not affect everyone in the same way. And so here's why human beings, right, The Anthropocene is the age in which human beings have become a primary driver of biophysical change on the planet. Yeah, helpful. But a particular kind of human being, if we're going to be honest, right? Remember I said this conceals something? The Anthropos, right, the human, the idealized human, the fictive human, at the center of this is the white extractive colonizing male. Or simply what Sylvia Winter calls man with a capital M, who presents itself as the universal. This is what it means to be truly human, to be man. And so the logics of man are what have primarily organized the space that has driven us into the Anthropocene and shaped the Anthropocene today. The logics of man. And those logics, and the world has been shaped to serve primarily, disproportionately, those who most fully partake in the identity of man. Throwing a lot at you. Let's bring it home again one more time. So, to give you a sense of how this continues today. So, these pictures are not, or these are related, but they're not directly related. This is an image of, you can see Shell there. In the late 90s and in the early 2000s, the Ogoni people in Western Nigeria protested what Shell was doing to their lands because Shell was going in there and in completely unregulated ways extracting the oil from below their lands. And, well, regulation is meant to keep places and people safe, but it costs money, so bites into accumulation of wealth. Shell wasn't going to worry about that. And they can, what's the word? They can think they can get away with it, and they can get away with it because of the racialized dynamics of this whole, right? So you have an image of what was taking place there. Kensaro Wiwa and the Ogoni Nine organized protests against this, and Shell went to the Nigerian government and said, you need to take care of them because we don't want this bad publicity. Sarawira was taken and killed by a death squad. Larry Summers, my man Larry Summers, who at the time was chief economist at the World Bank, argued in an internal memo that the export of pollution and toxic waste to the third world constituted an economically sound world welfare enhancing trade that should be actively encouraged by the World Bank. Summers goes on in the memo, and it's online, you can find it, goes on to state that in view of the lifespans of large segments of Africa's population, the quote-unquote underpopulated countries in Africa are vastly underpolluted. Summers concludes by his memo by rejecting notions that such a policy should not be carried out for moral reasons. Moral reasons. Yeah. So Summers, no, please keep in mind, right? Summers isn't like one of us sitting around saying, hey, I got an idea. Summers is the chief economist at the most powerful lending institution in the world.
President of Harvard.
He then became president of Harvard. He then went on to become the chief economic advisor to Bush, Obama, Bush, and Clinton. Maybe not the first Bush. Clinton, Bush, Obama for a little while. And you know what, I mean, the whole thing, right? Like, what do you say? But historians will say it's counterfactual, right? But there are regions in Africa, in Western Africa, that did not have the same kind of population demographic boom that most of the rest of the world did. And historians will say probably a prime cause for that was the effects of stealing people, the mass theft of persons to enslave them. Right. So that's a hell of a way to make reparations. This is the age of man. And look, this is a global example. I live in Baltimore, where we can talk about the white L, right? Which is, so Baltimore is a diamond, and you got the white L, and then you have the black butterfly. And it's a hell of a lot safer to live in the white L. There's a lot less toxins in the white L. Full disclosure, I live in the white L. Okay, so we're starting to unpack some, not all, of the dimensions of the planetary emergency that we need to think about. How do we practice Jubilee here? Right, that's what the goal of this is. Let me check my time. Okay, we have 8 to 10 minutes. If, as I just said, we can think about the Anthropocene as the age of man, well, that's really kind of like a historical phenomenological way of interpreting this, right? Like the phenomenon of man is a philosophical concept. How do we think of this through, as I said out there, through a lens of Christian faith? Who is the Anthropos at the center of this? I would suggest to you that Cain is an appropriate figure to think about as at the center of this. Right. Cain, who, and we'll unpack more of this day three. Cain, who starts off with the tools of the gardener, the tools to serve the soil and all that comes from the soil. We'll unpack more of that. Very quick, Cain's name, by the way, means spear or metal worker. It means like 18 different things, but it can mean spear or metal worker. We'll come back to those in a second. Cain, who, as the firstborn son, thinks himself exalted, thinks himself to be privileged, thinks the world is made for him. When God exercises a preferential option for the poor, Cain says, right? I'm going to take the one who ostensibly is my brother, and kill him. And then I'm going to flee from God, I'm going to flee from the soil that I was supposed to serve, and I'm going to go build a city. And the city here, I would say, we should primarily think of not as symbolically, right? We should think of it symbolically, not as urban space, but as Augustine would say, civilization. Or to use the language we've been developing, right? A system, a political ecological system. Cain goes off and builds a certain type of political ecology to serve Cain, to protect Cain. It's the story of the 500-year project of Western Utrecht. Who's my brother? Who's God? Me. Let me show you what the image of God looks like. So, how do we practice Jubilee here, in that space, in this space, right? What does Jubilee look like? Ah, forgot about the slide. So Francis, in Laudato Si, Pope Francis, talks about Cain, and he has this great line where he says, disregard for the duty to cultivate and maintain a proper relationship with my neighbor, for whose care and custody I am responsible, ruins my relationship with my own self, with others, with God, and with the earth. It's all connected. When all these relationships are neglected, when justice no longer dwells in the land, the Bible tells us that life itself is in danger. Cain's name. Cain ostensibly had the tools of the gardener to begin with in that story. His name means metal worker or spear. What you see in the story, in right, the symbolic story, symbols give rise to the thought. What you see in this story, right, is the narration of the antithesis of Isaiah's vision of peace, of salvation. Cain has the tools of the gardener, the plowshare, and the pruning hook, and beats it into the spear and the sword of the city. Jubilee is going to have to, it calls us to this. And calls us to this in the context of the Anthropocene, in the context of the histories of colonialism and all of that shit. It's a lot. Right? This is what we're going to be thinking about, though. Like how, what are the tools? What? Where do we start? Maybe you've already started, right? But how do we enter into this process or continue down this process of beating swords into plowshares, of releasing the soil and all that comes from the soil from the grasp of Cain, from the grasp of man, from the organization of Western tribal colonialism. We have just a couple minutes. If you would take a look at the poem Divorces from Eduardo Galeano, what I give you. If you don't have a sheet of poetry, I can give you one. Maybe I can give you one. I have like two left. Okay, yeah, if you can share, maybe.
You got one there? Oh, wait. But you, okay. Yeah,
I can share one.
Does he have one? Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. Thanks, Alan.
Our system is one of detachment to keep silenced people from asking questions, to keep the judged from judging, to keep solitary people from joining together, and the soul from putting together its pieces. Take a minute, if you want to sit in silence, or turn to a neighbor, think about this poem, maybe in relation to what we've just been talking about. If you just want to sit with it, that's fine as well. We have 2 minutes, so take a minute. So I want to ask for thoughts in a second. We're bushing up a comment. I just wanted to say one thing, and I'm sure I'm speaking for Paul here. I appreciate it very much yesterday when they made the announcements and gave you the orientation that they said, like, give us space. Like, I'm happy to, you can look me in the eye. Right? I'm happy to talk with you as our time here goes by. If I appreciate what they said, because so you know, like if I'm like, oh yeah, I want to talk to my kids right now, I'll let you know, and we're all. But in general, feel free to have a conversation with me. So if you want to stay and talk about the poem, I don't want to hold people up from their coffee or their break. We can do that. We'll move tomorrow to Paul, will lead us in a reflection on doing grief work in light of what we have to see and what we have to reflect and how to attend to our grief as an essential element of beating our swords and spears into plowshares of grief.
Was there an official date when the 500-year plan started?
Well, so it would be Columbus. Okay. Cristobal Colon landing in Arawak Island.
So,
well, it's an ongoing project.
Do you have the name of the artist that did this?
I will get that for you. I don't have those up right now.
Oh, sorry. Really quick. you can do this today, but you can do it any time during the week, but we will share these resources with you. We can give you a PDF of the slides and all that with your artwork and everything.
And we can get the artist names on
you. You want to put your information on here if you want that, okay? And you can do that now, you can do it tomorrow, with, you know, by the end of the week, whenever you would like. Okay?
So thank you all for being here. Hope to see you tomorrow, but thank you for all the time.